Our examination continues into the inner workings of the Supreme Court 50 years ago, as the justices weighed one of the most important cases of the 20th century. In part two of our series this week on Brown versus Board of Education, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg picks up the story in the fall of 1953. The court was about to hear argument for a second time in the school segregation cases when Chief Justice Fred Vinson died in his sleep.
Less than 3 weeks after Vinson's death, President Eisenhower nominated California Governor Earl Warren to be Chief Justice. A former district attorney and state attorney general, Warren had been a vocal proponent of the internment of the Japanese in World War II. He'd been elected governor of California three times and was a hugely successful chief executive, overhauling California's government to be a model of progressive enlightenment while at the same time maintaining a balanced budget. In 1948, he'd been the Republican vice presidential candidate, running with Thomas Dewey. He was a tall, white-haired bear of a man, modest but self-confident, a born leader. He was interested in everyone and everything, a trait that would serve him well in Washington. In a town of talkers, Warren was a listener. Compared to the dour Chief Justice Vinson, who'd seemed paralyzed by the segregation cases, Warren was a man so attuned to public consensus that the last time he ran for governor of California, he had the endorsement not only of the Republican Party, but the Democratic Party, too. Almost from the moment his booming voice could be heard in the halls of the Supreme Court, things were very different, observes Frank Sander, who clerked for Justice Felix Frankfurter that term.
There was a definite sense we had that the clouds had lifted and the sun was shining.
Law clerk Earl Pollack had started out clerking for Vinson, but now was working for Warren.
He was very unpretentious. He seemed to exude a kind of integrity. He was unlike Vinson in that he was very much of a public personality.
Vinson had been a politician, too, but he was a reserved man and a backroom dealer, though, of course, he'd been unable to close the biggest deal of his judicial career, the school segregation cases. Brown and its companion cases were re-argued on December 7th, 8th, and 9th of 1953. Once again, the principal voice of the South was the nation's preeminent appellate advocate, John W. Davis. As always, he wore a morning coat and striped pants. As always, his presentation was meticulous and formal. But on this occasion, the 80-year-old Davis seemed overcome by emotion, reminding the justices of Aesop's fable about a dog crossing a bridge with a piece of meat in his mouth, and when the dog saw his shadow in the stream, he plunged in for it, losing both the meat and the shadow. South Carolina, Davis told the court, had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to equalize education. Shall it be thrown away on some fancied question of racial prestige? As he spoke, Davis had tears on his cheeks. Marshall was more folksy in his presentation, telling the court colored and white children already play together, they play in the streets together, on their farms together, they're only separated for school, he said. When the argument was over and the justices convened for their conference, there was an immediate and apparent change. In place of Vinson, who'd seemed unwilling to overturn the separate but equal doctrine of Plessy versus Ferguson, there now sat Warren. According to notes kept by other justices that are read here by actors, Warren began by telling his fellow justices that the time for delay was over.
The more I read and hear and think, the more I come to conclude that the basis of the principle of segregation rests upon the basic premise that the Negro race is inferior. That is the only way to sustain Plessy. If oral argument proved anything, the arguments of Negro counsel proved that they are not inferior. I don't see how we can continue in this day and age to set one group apart from the rest.
Then Warren signaled that the real question was not whether to end segregation, but how.
It will take all the wisdom of the court to do this with a minimum of commotion and strife. How we do it is important. At present, my instincts and tentative feelings would lead me to say that in these cases, we should abolish, in a tolerant way, the practice of segregation in public schools.
Joining Warren in firmly calling for the reversal of Plessy were Justices Black, Douglas, Burton, and Minton. That left four others with varyingly strong reservations. Felix Frankfurter observed that history suggested that the authors of the 14th Amendment assumed schools would be segregated, and Congress had taken no action since to change that. Justice Robert Jackson agreed.
This is a political question. I don't know how to justify the abolition of segregation as a judicial act. If we have to decide this question, then representative government has failed. The problem is to make a judicial basis for a congenial political conclusion.
Tom Clark was hesitant, though he seemed more willing now that his longtime friend Chief Justice Vinson was gone from the scene. And at the conference, Clark cast the issue in very specific terms.
In Texas, several counties are predominantly Mexican. There's trouble with Mexicans and whites, and in the last few years they've been segregated in San Antonio and along the border. I don't like the system of segregation, and we'll vote to abolish it, but the remedy must be carefully worked out, and some variations permitted.
Justice Stanley Reed of Kentucky was still opposed. Back in his chambers, Reed was talking to his law clerk, John Fassett.
He very forthright told me, he said, they have the votes and they plan to do it. And finally I said to him, well, Justice Reed, don't you think that that's the right decision? And he said to me, I take it that you're in favor of tritocracy.
When Fassett asked what a tritocracy was, Reed sent him to the dictionary.
It's government by judges. He said he didn't believe that it was the job of judges to make that kind of decision.
Reed set Fassett to a variety of tasks, finding out what the role of the United Nations was vis-a-vis segregation, where else it existed in the world. He wanted a comparison of the criminal records of whites and blacks in comparable American cities. And the justice eventually gave his clerk pages of handwritten notes suggesting the outline of a dissent. Fassett transformed the notes into a dissent, annotated it with his own comments, and returned to tell the justice that he thought Reed had made a good case for segregation historically.
But I didn't think much of what he had written. And, you know, he never asked me for that back. He never sent it to get it typed.
Meanwhile, Warren was studiously avoiding taking any vote and trying to keep the issue in flux. The Chief Justice was a very patient man, says Warren's one-time law clerk Earl Pollock, and Warren was spending time with each justice privately as well as at the conference.
Now, he had the capacity to take his time. He did not place his ego ahead of the task to be done. I think he would have spent hours and hours with any of the justices in order to talk through what their concerns were, in order to develop the consensus that he was seeking.
There were pressures from outside, too, not very subtle ones. While the court was pondering the Brown case, Warren was invited to the White House for dinner. As the ranking guest, he sat next to President Eisenhower. Seated across the table was the man who had argued the case for the South in the Supreme Court, John W. Davis. The president, according to Warren, went to considerable lengths to tell him what a great man Davis was. After dinner, as Warren recounts in his memoirs,
the president took me by the arm, and as we walked along, speaking of the southern states in segregation cases, he said, "These are not bad people. All they are concerned about is to see that their sweet little girls are not required to sit in school alongside some big overgrown Negroes." Fortunately, by that time, others had filed into the room, so it was not necessary for me to reply.
Sometime in late February or early March, Warren was ready to take a vote. Most historians believe it was March, since Warren had been sitting as a recess appointee and was not actually confirmed until March. Though Warren in his memoirs indicates the vote was unanimous, the conference notes indicate there still were big question marks. Would Reed be able to go along, or Jackson? Jackson had been working on a concurring opinion for months, and on March 15th, he showed it to his law clerk. It was 23 pages long, and the first 21 of those pages were a sympathetic treatment of the South's segregation of the races and an explanation of all the reasons why the court should not intervene. Only in the last two pages did Jackson finally conclude that while segregation might once have been justified, it was no longer justifiable. Jackson's law clerk, 27-year-old Barrett Prettyman, spent several days reviewing the draft and wrote a remarkable memo to his boss.
I say this in all frankness. If you are going to reach the decision you do, you should not write as if you were ashamed to reach it. Someone must make these decisions, and under our system, the burden is on the courts.
The justice and his trusted clerk never had a chance to discuss the memo. For about a week after Prettyman delivered it, Jackson had a major heart attack and was hospitalized for the remainder of the term. Warren, meanwhile, was working alone without telling his clerks, crafting a draft opinion. He wrote it on a yellow legal pad in longhand, crossing out words as he went along, adding notes in tiny print in the margins. As he worked on the opinion, Warren decided to spend a few days touring Civil War monuments in the South. Off he went in a court car driven by his black driver. At the end of the first day, they stopped somewhere in Virginia at a hotel. Warren assumed his driver would stay someplace cheaper and made arrangements to be picked up the following morning. But when the Chief Justice emerged the next day, it was quickly apparent to him that his driver had slept in the car. Suddenly, it hit Warren that he had come to a place where a man in his employ could not find a place to sleep. As he later told an interviewer for Ebony magazine, he was overwhelmed by his own thoughtlessness.
I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. We turned back immediately and went home.
In mid or late April, Warren finally gave his draft to his clerk, Earl Pollock. The 28-year-old Northwestern graduate took it home and worked for 24 hours straight to get it into shape. The main change he suggested was to treat the Washington, D.C. case separately from the four state cases. Warren had tried to write something that would serve for all, but Pollock thought it was too cumbersome, since the legal questions and history involving the district were distinct from the state cases. Warren quickly agreed. Within a couple of weeks, the chief was ready to present the draft to his fellow justices. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.